Her first returning thought was that the darkness meant she was dead. Her second was that if she was dead, her right hand wouldn't feel as if it had first been napalmed, then flayed with razor blades. Her third was the dismayed realization that if it was dark and her eyes were open, as they seemed to be, then the sun had gone down. That jolted her up from the in-between place where she had been lying, not quite unconscious, but deep in a post-shock lassitude, in a hurry. At first she couldn't remember why the idea of sundown should be so frightening, and then, space cowboy, monster of love. It all came back to her in a rush so strong it was like an electrical shock. The narrow, corpse-white cheeks, the high forehead, the rapt eyes. The wind had come up strongly once more while she had been lying semi-conscious on the bed, and the back door was banging again. For a moment, the door and the wind were the only sounds, and then a long, wavering howl rose in the air. Jessie believed it was the most awful sound she had ever heard, the sound she imagined a victim of premature burial might make, after being disinterred and dragged, alive but insane, from her coffin. The sound faded into the uneasy night, and it was night, no doubt about that. But a moment later it came again, an inhuman falsetto, full of idiot terror. It rushed over her like a living thing, making her shudder helplessly on the bed and grope for her ears. She covered them, but could not shut out that terrible cry when it came a third time. "Oh, don't," she moaned. She had never felt so cold, don't. The howl funneled away into the gusty night and was not immediately renewed. Jessie had a moment to catch her breath and realized it was only a dog after all, probably the dog, in fact, the one who had turned her husband into its own personal McDonald's drive-thru. Then the cry was renewed, and it was impossible to believe any creature from the natural world could make such a sound. Surely it was a banshee, or a vampire writhing with a stake in its heart. As it rose toward its crystalline peak, Jessie suddenly understood why the animal was making that sound. It had come back, just as she had feared it would. The dog knew it, sensed it somehow. She was shivering all over. Her eyes feverishly scanned the corner where she had seen her visitor standing last night, the corner where it had left the pearl earring and the single footprint. It was far too dark to see either of these artifacts, always assuming they were there at all. But for a moment, Jessie thought she saw the creature itself, and she felt a scream rise in her throat. She closed her eyes tight, opened them again, and saw nothing but the wind-driven shadows of the trees outside the west windows. Far to the west, beyond the writhing shapes of the pines, she could see a fading band of gold on the line of the horizon. It might be 7 o'clock, but if I can still see the last of the sunset, it's probably not even that late. Which means I was only out for an hour and a half, 2 and a half tops. Maybe it's not too late to get out of here. Maybe. This time the dog seemed actually to scream. The sound made Jessie feel like screaming back. She grasped one of the footposts because she had started to sway on her feet again, and suddenly realized she couldn't remember getting off the bed in the first place. That was how much the dog had freaked her out. Get control of yourself, girl. Take a deep breath and get control of yourself. She did take a deep breath, and the smell she drew in with the air was one she knew. It was like that flat mineral smell which had haunted her all these years, the smell that meant sex, water, and father to her. But not exactly like that. Some other odor or odors seemed mixed into this version of it. Old garlic, ancient onions, dirt, unwashed feet maybe. The smell tumbled Jessie back down a well of years, and filled her with a helpless, inarticulate terror children feel when they sense some faceless, nameless creature, some it, waiting patiently beneath the bed for them to stick out a foot, or perhaps dangle a hand. The wind gusted, the door banged, and somewhere closer by, a board creaked stealthily, the way boards do when someone who is trying to be quiet treads lightly upon them. "It's come back," her mind whispered. It was all the voices now. They had entwined in a braid. "That's what the dog smells. That's what you smell. And Jesse, that's what made the board creak. The thing that was here last night has come back for you." "Oh, God, please, no," she moaned. "Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. Oh, dear God, don't let that be true." She tried to move, but her feet were frozen to the floor, and her left hand was nailed to the bedpost. Her fear had immobilized her as surely as oncoming headlights immobilize a deer or rabbit caught in the middle of the road. She would stand here, moaning under her breath and trying to pray, until it came to her, came for her, the space cowboy, the reaper of love, just some door-to-door salesman of the dead, his sample case filled with bones and finger rings instead of Amway or Fuller brushes. The dog's ululating cry rose in the air, rose in her head, until she thought it must surely drive her mad. "I'm dreaming," she thought. "That's why I couldn't remember standing up. Dreams are the mind's version of Reader's Digest condensed books, and you can never remember unimportant stuff like that when you're having one. I passed out, yes. That really happened. Only instead of going down into a coma, I came up into natural sleep. I guess that means the bleeding must have stopped, because I don't think people who are bleeding to death have nightmares when they're going down for the count. I'm sleeping, that's all. Sleeping and having the granddaddy of all bad dreams." A fabulously comforting idea, and only one thing wrong with it. It wasn't true. The dancing tree shadows on the wall by the bureau was real. So was that weird smell drifting through the house. She was awake, and she had to get out of here. "I can't move," she wailed. "Yes, you can," Ruth told her grimly. "You didn't get out of those fucking handcuffs just to die of fright, Tootsie. Get moving, now. I don't need to tell you how to do it, do I?" "No," Jesse whispered, and slapped lightly at the bedpost with the back of her right hand. The result was an immediate and enormous skyrocket of pain. The vice of panic which had been holding her shattered like glass, and when the dog voiced another of those freezing howls, Jesse barely heard it. Her hand was a lot closer, and it was howling a lot louder. "And you know what to do next, Toots, don't you?" Yes. The time had come to make like a hockey player and get the puck out of here, to make like a library and book. The thought of Gerald's rifle surfaced for a second, and then she dismissed it. She didn't have the slightest idea where the gun was, or even if it was here at all. Jessie walked slowly and carefully across the room on her trembling legs, once again holding out her left hand to steady her balance. The hallway beyond the bedroom door was a carousel of moving shadows, with the door to the guest room standing open on the right, and the small spare room Gerald used as a study standing open on the left. Further down on the left was the archway which gave on the living room. On the right was the unlatched back door, the Mercedes, and maybe freedom. 50 steps, she thought. Can't be any more than that, and it's probably less. So get going, okay? But at first she just couldn't. Bizarre as it would undoubtedly seem to someone who hadn't been through what she had been through during the last 28 hours or so, the bedroom represented a kind of dour safety to her. The hallway, however, anything might be lurking out there. Anything. Then something which sounded like a thrown stone thudded against the west side of the house, just outside the windows. Jessie uttered her own small howl of terror before realizing it was just the branch of the hoary old blue spruce out there by the deck. "Get hold of yourself," Punkin said sternly. "Get hold of yourself and get out of here!" She tottered gamely onward, left arm still out, counting steps under her breath as she went. She passed the guest bedroom at 12. At 15 she reached Gerald's study, and as she did, she began to hear a low, toneless, hissing sound, like steam escaping a very old radiator. At first Jessie did not associate the sound with the study. She thought she was making it herself. Then, as she was raising her right foot to make the 16th step, the sound intensified. This time it registered more clearly, and Jessie realized she couldn't be the one making it, because she was holding her breath. Slowly, very slowly, she turned her head toward the study, where her husband would never again work on legal briefs while he chain-smoked Marlboros and sang old Beach Boys hits under his breath. The house was now groaning around her like an old ship plowing through a moderately heavy sea, creaking in its various joints as the wind shouldered against it with cold air. Now she could hear a clapping shutter as well as the banging door. But these sounds were somewhere else, in some other world where wives were not handcuffed, and husbands did not refuse to listen, and night creatures did not stalk. She could hear the muscles and tendons in her neck creaking like old bedsprings as she turned her head. Her eyes throbbed in their sockets like chunks of hot charcoal. "I don't want to look!" her mind screamed. "I don't want to look! I don't want to see!" But she was helpless not to look. It was as if strong, invisible hands were turning her head, while the wind gusted and the back door banged, and the shutter clapped, and the dog once more sent its desolate, bone-chilling howl spiraling into the black October sky. Her head turned until she was looking into her dead husband's study. And yes, sure enough, there it was, a tall figure standing beside Gerald's Ames chair and in front of the sliding glass door. Its narrow white face hung in the darkness like a stretched skull. The dark, squarish shadow of its souvenir case squatted between its feet. She drew in breath to scream with, but what came out was a sound like a tea kettle with a broken whistle. Only that, and nothing more. Somewhere in that other world, hot urine was running down her legs. She had wet her pants for a second record-breaking day. The wind gusted in that other world, making the house shiver on its bones. The blue spruce knocked its branch against the west wall again. Gerald's study was a lagoon of dancing shadows, and it was once more very difficult to tell what she was seeing, or if she was in fact seeing anything at all. The dog raised its keen, horrified cry again, and Jessie thought, "Oh, you're seeing it all right. Maybe not as well as the dog out there is smelling it, but you are seeing it." As if to remove any lingering doubts she might have had on this score, her visitor poked its head forward in a kind of parody of inquisitiveness, giving Jessie a clear but mercifully brief look at it. The face was that of an alien being that has tried to mimic human features without much success. It was too narrow, for one thing, narrower than any face Jessie had ever seen in her life. The nose seemed to have no more thickness than a butter knife. The high forehead bulged like a grotesque garden bulb. The thing's eyes were simple black circles below the thin, upside-down V's of its brows. Its pudgy, liver-colored lips seemed to be simultaneously pouting and melting. No, not melting, she thought, with the bright, narrow lucidity that sometimes lives like the glowing filament in a light bulb, within a sphere of complete terror. Not melting. Smiling. It's trying to smile at me. Then it bent over to grasp its case, and its narrow, incoherent face was mercifully lost from view again. Jesse staggered back a step, tried to scream again, and could only produce another loose, glassy whisper. The wind moaning around the eaves was louder. Her visitors straightened up again, holding the case with one hand and unlatching it with the other. Jesse realized two things, not because she wanted to, but because her mind's ability to pick and choose what it would sense had been completely demolished. The first had to do with the smell she had noted earlier. It wasn't garlic or onions or sweat or dirt. It was rotting flesh. The second had to do with the creature's arms. Now that she was closer and could see better, she wished it weren't so, but it was. They impressed her more forcibly. Freakish, elongated things that seemed to waver in the wind-driven shadows like tentacles. They presented the case to her as if for her approval. And now Jesse saw it was not a traveling salesman's case, but a wicker box that looked like an oversized fisherman's creel. "I've seen a box like that before," she thought. "I don't know if it was on some old TV show or in real life, but I have. When I was just a little girl, it came out of a long black car with a door in the back." A soft and sinister UFO voice suddenly spoke up inside her. "Once upon a time, Jesse, when President Kennedy was still alive, and all little girls were pumpkins, and the plastic body bag had yet to be invented. Back in the time of the eclipse, let us say, boxes like this were common. They came in all sizes, from men's extra large to 6-month miscarriage. Your friend keeps his souvenirs in an old-fashioned mortician's body box, Jesse." As she realized this, she realized something else as well. It was perfectly obvious once you thought about it. The reason her visitor smelled so bad was because it was dead. The thing in Gerald's study was a walking corpse. No. No, that can't be. But it was. She had smelled exactly the same thing on Gerald not 3 hours ago. Had smelled it in Gerald, simmering in his flesh like some exotic disease which can only be caught by the dead. Now her visitor was opening the box again and holding it out to her, and once again she saw the golden glitters and diamond flashes amid the heaps of bone. Once again she watched as the narrow dead man's hand reached in and began to stir the contents of the wicker body box, a box which had perhaps once held the corpses of infants or very small children. Once again she heard the tenebrous click and whisk of bones, a sound like dirt-clogged castanets. Jesse stared, hypnotized and almost ecstatic with terror. Her sanity was giving way. She could feel it going, almost hear it, and there wasn't a thing on God's green earth she could do about it.
"Yes, there is. You can run. You have to run. And you have to do it now!"
It was Pumpkin, and she was shrieking, but she was also a long way off, lost in some deep stone gorge in Jesse's head. There were lots of gorges in there, she was discovering, and lots of dark, twisty canyons and caves that had never seen the light of the sun, places where the eclipse never ended, you might say. It was interesting. Interesting to find that a person's mind was really nothing but a graveyard, built over a black hollow place, with freakish reptiles like this crawling around the bottom. Interesting. Outside, the dog howled again, and Jessie finally found her voice. She howled with it, a dog-like sound from which most of her sanity had been subtracted. She could imagine herself making sounds like that in some madhouse, making them for the rest of her life. She found she could imagine that very easily.
Jessie, no! Hold on! Hold on to your mind and run! Run away!
Her visitor was grinning at her, its lips wrinkling away from its gums, once again revealing those glimmers of gold at the back of its mouth, glimmers that reminded her of Gerald. Gold teeth. It had gold teeth, and that meant it was...
It means it's real, yes. But we've already established that, haven't we? The only question left is what you're going to do now. Got any ideas, Jessie? If you do, you better trot them out, because time has gotten awfully short.
The apparition stepped forward, still holding its case open, as if it expected her to admire the contents. It was wearing a necklace, she saw, some weird sort of necklace. The thick, unpleasant smell was growing stronger. So was that unmistakable feeling of malevolence. Jessie tried to take a compensatory step back for the one the visitor had taken toward her, and found that she couldn't move her feet. It was as if they had been glued to the floor.
"It means to kill you, Toots," Ruth said,
and Jessie understood this was true. "Are you going to let it?" There was no anger or sarcasm in Ruth's voice now. Only curiosity. After all that's happened to you, are you really going to let it? The dog howled. The hand stirred. The bones whispered. The diamonds and rubies flashed their dim night fire. Hardly aware of what she was doing, let alone why she was doing it, Jessie grasped her own rings, the ones on the third finger of her left hand, with the wildly trembling thumb and forefinger of her right. The pain across the back of that hand as she squeezed was dim and distant. She had worn the rings almost constantly across all the days and years of her marriage, and the last time she'd taken them off, she'd had to soap her finger. Not this time. This time they slid off easily. She held her bloody right hand out to the creature, who had now come all the way to the bookcase just inside the entrance to the study. The rings lay on her palm in a mystic figure eight below the makeshift sanitary napkin bandage. The creature stopped. The smile on its pudgy, misshapen mouth faltered into some new expression, which might have been anger or only confusion.
"Here," Jessie said in a harsh, choked growl. "Here, take them. Take them and leave me alone."
Before the creature could move, she threw the rings at the open case as she had once thrown coins at the exact change baskets on the New Hampshire Turnpike. There was less than 5 feet between them now. The mouth of the case was large, and both rings went in. She distinctly heard the double click as her wedding and engagement bands fell against the bones of the strangers. The thing's lips wrinkled back from its teeth again, and it once more began to utter that sibilant, creamy hiss. It took another step forward, and something which had been lying stunned and unbelieving on the floor of her mind, awoke.
"No!" she screamed.
She turned and went lurching up the hallway while the wind gusted and the door banged and the shutter clapped and the dog howled. And it was right behind her. It was. She could hear that hissing sound. And at any moment it would reach out for her, a narrow white hand floating at the end of a fantastic arm as long as a tentacle. She would feel those rotting white fingers close on her throat. Then she was at the back door. She was opening it. She was spilling out onto the stoop and tripping over her own right foot. She was falling, and somehow reminding herself even as she went down to turn her body so she would land on her left side. She did, but still hit hard enough to see stars. She rolled over onto her back, lifted her head, and stared at the door, expecting to see the narrow white face of the space cowboy loom behind the screen. It didn't, and she could no longer hear the hissing sound either. Not that those things meant much. It could hurtle into view any second, seize her, and tear her throat out. Jessie struggled to her feet, managed one step, and then her legs, trembling with a combination of shock and blood loss, betrayed her, and spilled her back to the planks next to the wire-covered compartment which held the garbage. She moaned and looked up at the sky, where clouds filigreed by a moon three-quarters full were racing from west to east at lunatic speed. Shadows rolled across her face like fabulous moving tattoos. Then the dog howled again, sounding much closer now that she was outside, and that provided the tiny bit of extra incentive that she needed. She reached up to the garbage compartment's low, sloped top with her left hand, felt around for the handle, and used it to haul herself to her feet. Once she was up, she held the handle tightly until the world stopped swaying. Then she let go and walked slowly toward the Mercedes, now holding out both arms for balance. "How like a skull the house looks in the moonlight," she marveled, following her first wide-eyed, frantic look back. "How very like a skull! The door is its mouth, the windows are its eyes, the shadows of the trees are its hair." Then another thought occurred, and it must have been amusing because she screamed laughter into the windy night. "And the brain! Don't forget the brain! Gerald's the brain, of course. The house is dead and rotting brain." She laughed again as she reached the car, louder than ever, and the dog howled in answer. "My dog has fleas, they bite his knees," she thought. Her own knees buckled, and she grabbed the door handle to keep from falling down in the driveway. And she never stopped laughing as she did it. Exactly why she was laughing was beyond her. She might understand if the parts of her mind which had shut down in self-defense ever woke up again. But that wasn't going to happen until she got out of here, if she ever did. "I imagine I'll need a transfusion, too, eventually," she said. And that caused another outburst of laughter. She reached clumsily across to her right pocket with her left hand, still laughing. She was feeling around for the key when she realized the smell was back, and that the creature with a wicker case was standing right behind her. Jessie turned her head, laughter still in her throat and a grin still twitching her lips, and for a moment she did see those narrow cheeks and rapt bottomless eyes. But she only saw them because of the eclipse. How afraid she was. Not because there was really anything there. The back stoop was still deserted, the screen door a tall rectangle of darkness. "But you better hurry," Goodwife Burlingame said. "Yes, you better make like a hockey player while you still can, don't you think?" "Going to make like an amoeba and split," Jessie agreed, and laughed some more as she pulled the key out of her pocket. It almost slipped through her fingers, but she caught it by the oversized plastic fob. "You sexy thing," Jessie said, and laughed hilariously as the door banged and the dead cowboy specter of love came charging out of the house in a dirty white cloud of bone dust. But when she turned, almost dropping the key again in spite of the oversized fob, there was nothing there. It was only the wind which had banged the door, only that, and nothing more. She opened the driver's door, slid behind the wheel of the Mercedes, and managed to pull her trembling legs in after her. She slammed the door, and as she pushed down the master lock which locked all the other doors, plus the trunk, of course, there was really nothing in the world quite like German efficiency. An inexpressible sense of relief washed over her. Relief and something else. That something else felt like sanity, and she thought she had never felt anything in her life which could compare with its sweet and perfect return, except for that first drink of water from the tap, of course. Jessie had an idea that was going to end up being the all-time champion. How close was I to going mad in there? How close, really? That might not be a thing you ever want to know for sure, Toots, Ruth Neary returned gravely. No, maybe not. Jessie stuck the key in the ignition and turned it. Nothing happened. The last of the laughter dried up, but she didn't panic. She still felt sane and relatively whole. Think, Jessie. She did, and the answer came almost at once. The Mercedes was getting along in years. She wasn't sure they ever really got anything so vulgar as old. And the transmission had started doing some annoying little tricks lately, German efficiency or no German efficiency. One of them was a failure to start sometimes, unless the driver shoved up on the shift lever poking out of the console between the bucket seats, and shoved up hard. Turning the ignition key while pushing up on the transmission lever was an operation which would take both hands, and her right was already throbbing horribly. The thought of using it to shove on the transmission lever made her cringe, and not just because of the pain. She was quite sure it would also cause the deep incision across her inner wrist to break open again. "Please, God, I need a little help here," Jessie whispered, and turned the ignition key again. Still nothing, not even a click. And now a new idea stole into her head like a nasty-tempered little burglar. Her inability to start the car had nothing at all to do with a little glitch that had developed in the transmission. This was more of her visitor's work. It had cut the telephone lines. It had also raised the hood of the Mercedes long enough to rip off the distributor cap and throw it into the woods. The door banged. She glanced nervously in that direction, quite sure that she had seen its white, grinning face in the darkness of the foyer for just a moment. In another moment or two, it would come out. It would grab a rock and smash the car window, then take one of the thick slivers of safety glass and... Jessie reached across her waist with her left hand and shoved the knob of the transmission lever as hard as she could, although it did not, in truth, seem to move at all. Then she reached clumsily through the lower arc of the steering wheel with her right hand, grasped the ignition key, and turned it again. More nothing, except for the silent, chuffing laughter of the monster that was watching her. That she could hear quite clearly, even if only in her mind.
"Please, God, can't I have just one fucking break?"
she screamed. The transmission lever wiggled a little under her palm, and when Jessie turned the key over to the start position this time, the engine roared to life. "Ja, mein Führer," she sobbed with relief, and turned on the headlights. A pair of brilliant orange-yellow eyes glared at her from the driveway. She screamed, feeling her heart trying to tear itself loose of its plumbing, cram itself into her throat, and strangle her. It was the dog, of course, the stray who had been, in a manner of speaking, Gerald's last client. The former prince stood stock still, momentarily dazzled by the glare of the headlights. If Jessie had dropped the transmission into drive just then, she probably would have driven forward and killed it. The thought even crossed her mind, but in a distant, almost academic way. Her hate and fear of the dog had gone. She saw how scrawny it was, and how the burdocks stuck in its matted coat, a coat too thin to offer much protection against the coming winter. Most of all, she saw the way it cringed against the light, its ears drooping, its hindquarters shrinking against the driveway. "I didn't think it was possible," she thought. "But I've come across something that's even more scared than I am." She hit the Mercedes horn ring with the heel of her left hand. It uttered a single brief sound, more burp than beep, but it was enough to get the dog started. It turned and vanished into the woods without so much as a single look back. follow its example, Jess. Get out of here while you still can. Good idea. In fact, it was the only idea. She reached across her body again with her left hand, this time to pull the transmission lever down into drive. It caught with its usual reassuring little hitch and began rolling slowly up the paved driveway. The wind-driven trees shimmied like shadow dancers on either side of the car, sending the fall's first tornado funnels of leaves whirling up into the night sky. I'm doing it, Jessie thought with wonder. I'm actually doing it. Actually getting the puck out of here. She was rolling up the driveway, rolling toward the unnamed wheel track which would take her to Bay Lane, which would in its turn take her to Route 117 and civilization. As she watched the house, it looked more than ever like a huge white skull in the windy October moonlight. Shrink in the rearview mirror, she thought. Why is it letting me go? And is it really part of her? The fear-maddened part which would never entirely escape the handcuffs and the master bedroom of the house on the upper bay of Kashwakamak Lake assured her that it wasn't. The creature with the wicker case was only playing with her, as a cat plays with a wounded mouse. Before she got much further, certainly before she got to the top of the driveway, it would come racing after her, using its long cartoon legs to close the distance between them, stretching out its long cartoon arms to seize the rear bumper and bring the car to a halt. German efficiency was fine, but when you were dealing with something which had come back from the dead, well. But the house continued to dwindle in the rearview mirror, and nothing came out of the back door. Jessie reached the top of the driveway, turned right, and began to follow her high beams down the narrow wheel ruts toward Bay Lane, guiding the car with her left hand. Every second or third August, a volunteer crew of summer residents, fueled mostly by beer and gossip, cut back the underbrush and trimmed the overhanging branches along the way out to Bay Lane. But this had been an off year, and the lane was much narrower than Jessie liked. Each time a wind-driven branch tapped at the car's roof or body, she cringed a little. Yet she was escaping. One by one, the landmarks she had learned over the years made their appearance in the headlights and then dwindled behind her. The huge rock with the split top, the overgrown gate with a faded sign reading Rideout's Hideout nailed to it, the uprooted spruce leaning amid a stand of smaller spruces, like a large drunk being carried home by a smaller, livelier friend. The drunk spruce was only 0.3 miles from Bay Lane, and it was only 2 miles to the highway from there. I can handle it if I take it easy, she said, and pushed the radio on button with her right thumb, doing it very carefully. Bach, mellow, stately, and above all rational, flooded the car from four directions. Better and better. Take it easy, she repeated, speaking a little louder. Go greasy. Even the last shock, the stray dog's glaring orange eyes, was fading a little now, although she could feel herself beginning to shake. No problems whatsoever. If I just take it easy. She was doing that all right. Maybe a little too easy, in fact. The speedometer needle was barely touching the 10-mile-per-hour mark. Being safely locked in the familiar surroundings of one's own car was a wonderful restorative. Already she had begun to wonder if she hadn't been jumping at shadows all along. But this would be a very bad time to begin taking things for granted. If there had been someone in the house, he... It... Some deeper voice... The UFO of all UFOs insisted. Might have used one of the other doors to leave the house. He might be following her right now. It was even possible that were she to continue puddling along at a mere 10 miles an hour, a really determined follower might catch up. Jessie flicked her eyes up to the rearview mirror, wanting to reassure herself that this idea was only paranoia induced by shock and exhaustion. and felt her heart fall dead in her chest. Her left hand dropped from the wheel and thumped into her lap on top of the right. That should have hurt like hell, but there was no pain. Absolutely none at all. The stranger was sitting in the back seat with its eerily long hands pressed against the sides of its head, like the monkey that hears no evil. Its black eyes stared at her with sublimely empty interest.
You see, me see, we see, nothing but shadows.
Punkin cried, but this cry was more than distant. It seemed to have originated at the other end of the universe, and it wasn't true. It was more than shadows she saw in the mirror. The thing sitting back there was tangled in shadows, yes, but not made of them. She saw its face, bulging brow, round black eyes, blade-thin nose, plump, misshapen lips.
Jesse,
the space cowboy whispered ecstatically.
Nora, Ruth, my oh my, pumpkin pie.
Her eyes, frozen on the mirror, saw her passenger lean slowly forward, saw its swollen forehead nodding toward her right ear, as if the creature intended to tell her a secret. She saw its pudgy lips slide away from its jutting, discolored teeth in a grimacing, vapid smile. It was at this point that the final breakup of Jesse Burlingame's mind began.
No!
It cried, in a voice as thin as the voice of a vocalist on a scratchy old 78 RPM record.
No, please, no. It's not fair. Jesse.
Its stinking breath as sharp as a rasp and as cold as the air inside a meat locker.
Nora, Jesse, Ruth, Jesse, Pumpkin, Goodwife, Jesse, Mommy.
Her bulging eyes noted that the long white face was now half hidden in her hair, and its grinning mouth was almost kissing her ear as it whispered its delicious secret over and over and over.
Jesse, Nora, Goody, Pumpkin, Jesse, Jesse, Jesse.
There was a white airburst inside her eyes, and what it left behind was a big dark hole. As Jesse dove into it, she had one final coherent thought.
I shouldn't have looked at it. It burned my eyes after all.
Then she fell forward toward the wheel in a faint. As the Mercedes struck one of the large pines which bordered this section of the road, the seatbelt locked and jerked her backward again. The crash would probably have triggered the airbag if the Mercedes had been of a model recent enough to have come equipped with a system. It was not hard enough to damage the engine or even cause it to stall. Good old German efficiency had triumphed again. The bumper and the grill were dented, and the hood ornament was knocked askew, but the engine idled contentedly away to itself. After about 5 minutes, a microchip buried in the dashboard sensed that the motor was now warm enough to turn on the heater. Blowers under the dash began to whoosh softly. Jesse had slumped sideways against the driver's door, where she lay with her cheek pressed to the window, looking like a tired child who has finally given up and gone to sleep with Grandma's house just over the next hill. Above her, the rearview mirror reflected the empty back seat and the empty moonlit lane behind it.